Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Maggs.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, government moves to blacklist failing contractors as Public Works launches a tough new infrastructure accountability plan. Take-home pay climbs for a six-month, signalling tentative labour market recovery, a digital boost for South Africa's transport system as experts call for smart tech, and Microsoft unveils a youth digital skills program it's aiming to accelerate South Africa's entry into the AI economy. It's Thursday, the 30th of October. Now, I don't think I need to say that South Africans are tired of half-built clinics, abandoned schools, and budgets that often disappear long before the buildings arrive. Now, the Public Works Minister, Dean McPherson, has announced what he calls a decisive construction action plan, promising to blacklist failing contractors, ring-fence budgets, digitize project tracking, and also broadly professionalize the public sector. It's a bold reset for a department that he admits has been plagued by waste, weak controls, and loss of public confidence. I guess the question today is what this plan means in terms of delivery and whether it's just another policy promise waiting to stall in the mud. So, Minister, a very warm welcome. And you say that you see what South Africans see and that frustration is justified. What are South Africans seeing and why has it taken so long for Public Works to admit systemic failure?
Thanks, Jeremy, and great to be with you. Yeah, I feel the anger and I'm as frustrated as any other South African is when they see a half-built project that the Department of Public Works, either nationally or provincially, is dealing with. It's a source of irritation because it just means that poor planning has taken place, budgets have disappeared, and people aren't held accountable. So we've sought to look at what are the root causes for that and say, you know, in a systematic way, working nationally and with the provinces, how can we try and recover lost ground and then actually set forward a vision that ensures that projects are completed on time and on budget. And so we have to try and get some of the basics right, just like ensuring accountability, that contractors cannot bounce around the country ripping off the state, whether it be a province or nationally, and get away with it. And, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to be blacklisted entirely. Just making sure that we have qualified and registered professionals to do the work. And so what they say they can do, they are able to do. And as you mentioned in your intro, you know, using digital technology to be able to map out the problems, have line of sight and be able to track progress or stalling so that we can then intervene there and then.
Why has it taken so long to implement?
Well, look, I mean, you know, we've been in office for nearly a year and a half. It takes time to actually see what's under the hood of the car and try and actually diagnose what needs to be done. I mean, I can't explain for what's taken place before that, but what we've said is we've diagnosed the problem. We've done a lot of research into why it is the way that it is. We've also done some benchmarking on places that have got it right and then said, actually, you know, that we need to put together a plan that is not just a plan in itself, but actually has deadlines and timelines, reporting mechanisms, and people are held accountable. And we made it very clear to all the senior officials in Johannesburg on Tuesday that it's no longer the case of, oops, you've made a mistake. Mm. It's, you know, you've done this. It's now time to move on and go do something else. But the Department of Public Works, both provincially and nationally, is going to be one of excellence and one that we actually deliver on.
So let's talk about accountability, Minister. You promised to blacklist non-performing contractors, all well and good. So when's the first list going to be published and will it include politically connected individuals?
Well, we've already blacklisted 40, Jeremy, just in the last 12 months. And contrast that to one company that was blacklisted in 22 years. I think that we are showing that we mean business. You know, I've said, Jeremy, that it should be an honor to do business with the state. You should see it as service to serve your country, to build schools and hospitals and clinics. Unfortunately, it's seen as an opportunity to rip off the state. So I don't care who you are or what membership card you carry. If your business doesn't perform for the department, either nationally or provincially, you will be blacklisted and you won't be able to operate anywhere. So we also want to build a culture of excellence so that we try and encourage people to go to higher levels. On that score, we've said, well, let's actually show at the beginning of the financial year the full pipeline and not just in bits and pieces. So we actually encourage people that if you do good work, there's actually a lot more work coming down the road, and that also helps on pricing as well.
The devil, though, is often in the detail. Contractors, as you well know, Minister, often reappear under new company names. Is there a concrete procedure or mechanism that's going to stop shell company recycling, evidence of which we see all the time?
Yeah, so that's a good point, Jeremy. And the province has particularly highlighted that. And we learned this lesson from Limpopo, where they have set up what they called a restriction committee, that any person or business who does business with the state and fails to deliver, they get added to the restriction committee. And then that then gets shared with municipalities and other spheres of the state so that those companies or individuals can't reappear in another province or another department. So all provinces will now be required to set up restriction committees, collate that database, which will be managed by the Construction Industry Development Board, and then they will be blacklisted at a national level so that a flag goes against those companies and individuals that then no arm of the state can or should do business, and then they will also be given to Treasury as well. So we want to try and spread that information and that data as wide as possible, which is why data and analytics is going to be so crucial to us getting this right.
You also said that budgets are going to be ring-fenced and funds protected from diversion, all well and good. But it's going to be difficult, surely, Minister, to enforce that when pressure hits the provinces.
That's true, Jeremy, and that's why it's going to have to be in collaboration with treasuries. We're going to have that conversation. We've started advocating for that to say, you know, if you're going to commit to a three-year budget on a project, you can't pull that budget halfway through. That then puts us in a difficult position as to where that funding is supposed to come from. And that's why incomplete projects are a multifaceted problem. And just if we solved the budget issue alone, Jeremy, we would see immense progress. We have so many projects that are sitting at 70, 80% completion, but the budgets get moved because of funding pressures or, you know, other requirements come along. And that just can't be allowed. That's why we've also linked it to audit outcomes. And we've said to the Auditor General that rightfully so, you must audit public works for what they do or don't deliver. But you must also audit client departments that don't pay on time or withhold funding. They can't get away with that problem while we sit with their problem. So it is a difficult conversation. I think we can get it right. There's definitely a broad agreement within the public works family in provinces that their treasuries need to do the same. So they're going to go back to their treasuries. I'm going to go back to mine, and we're going to lobby hard to get that institutionalized.
Public Works Minister Dean McPherson, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Let's move on to this now. And South Africa's labor market is showing, I think, a flicker of recovery. Pay Inc's latest net salary index pointing to six straight months of rising take-home pay and more than 175,000 additional salaries paid this year. Now, that's encouraging on the surface, but with employment still around 33%, real income growth is fragile, wage expectations potentially outpacing productivity. The picture, I would suggest, is far from settled. So let's talk a little bit further about this. Economist Elise Kruger is with me. She says this could be the second consecutive year of real earnings growth, but warning, it will only matter if the economy can absorb new entrants and sustain productivity gains. So let's discuss whether this improvement is real momentum or just a temporary lift in our sluggish economy. Elise, it's always good to talk to you. 6 months then of rising net salary sounds positive, but unemployment, as I mentioned, stuck at around 33%. Do you think the recovery is only benefiting those already in work rather than creating new opportunities?
Jeremy, yes, one can almost derive that. So those with jobs at the moment, you know, are enjoying a real increase in wages, given that inflation is quite moderate. But yes, you know, we are sort of encouraged by the extra salaries paid so far this year, but it's not actually making a dent in our unemployment rate, and it's not enough opportunities to absorb all our new entrants. So we are remaining stuck in this unemployment situation that is not a long-term sustainable scenario. So we need more growth to create more job opportunities. But if I look at the current data at Pay Inc., then it does suggest that those with salaries are not too bad off this year, and it's actually following through from last year, where we already seen like a 1.5% real increase in wages.
The index shows average take-home pay up around 4.3%, Elise, if I've read these numbers correctly. Is that genuine earnings power, or are we simply catching up after years of stagnation?
Yes, that is a good question, because we had a couple of really bad years in terms of high inflation and salaries not keeping up. So those were specifically 2021 to 2023. And, you know, depending on where you start your analysis, you know, if you do start, say, around 2000, then you would see that actually salaries have not quite caught up yet with, you know, the inflation trajectory over that time period. So we had a couple of years where salary earners definitely were on the back foot. But now we're all moving, we're catching up, but we're not yet, you know, really in terms of purchasing power back there. That's why you would typically hear a lot of salary earners saying, you know, this is what you are telling us, but we are still feeling the strain of the high cost of living, because it has been building over time. But I would say there's some, you know, hope in the sense that the last 2 years, with inflation then having dropped so much, that we are looking at a somewhat better scenario.
Well, let me pick you up on inflation. Wage settlements, according to the numbers, are coming in at around 5 to 6%. Inflation is closer to 3%. Do rising wages without matching productivity then threaten our competitiveness?
Yes, indeed. So it's positive, you know, the fact that we are seeing the rising wages from a purchasing power point of view. But for a company, if there is not a productivity gain at the same time, then it is actually a drag in terms of their profitability. So we need to see productivity also rise in line with the increase in wages to be beneficial for the overall economy.
Elise, I want to come back, circle back to that 175,000 salaries in 9 months. In an economy of our size, do you think this is real job creation, or maybe just seasonal hiring or even contract cycling?
It is a combination of both, Jeremy, because we are looking at salaries in this sample from like 5,000 all the way up to 100,000 net salaries in terms of the, you know, the different bands. So, you know, in the very low income category, it could be also seasonal. So, however, you know, all of these salaries need to go through the national payment system to be taken up into the sample. So it is a real job, but it might not last. And we have seen quite a bit of volatility, you know, in the numbers. To give you a feel for the like, quarterly numbers, in January, you know, we had a big plus. In second quarter, we had a drop of about 120,000 salaries less paid. And now in the third quarter, we've got an increase of, say, 48,000. So there is quite a bit of volatility in the sample, and that, you know, does point to the fact that some of this is sometimes a temporary position or maybe a seasonal position.
There is worry, of course, that if wages rise faster than productivity, we could start seeing companies automate more quickly, and there's a lot of evidence as far as that is concerned, and that effectively prices out low or semi-skilled workers. I guess, though, in many ways, it's a reality that we're going to have to start to live with.
Yes, I think the structural changes, you know, that is occurring in the labour market, you know, as a result of technology, as a result of AI. You know, those are all very relevant factors that will impact on the labour market currently already, but also I think so more so in the years to come. So it is an important factor, and we need to look at, you know, upskilling the very low and semi-skilled, you know, workers to be able to absorb them into this, you know, new technology type of world that we're living or moving into.
You also caution that our sustainability going forward depends on productivity growth. That obviously makes sense. Is there a single structural reform that you think is needed to move the productivity needle more quickly in this country?
So I'm not sure about a single structural reform, Jeremy. I think there's a combination of factors. On the one side, I do believe that, you know, the educational side of things and skills development is an area where we need to focus a lot, you know, to prepare us for the new world that we're going to have to live in. And from that point of view, I think we have a scenario where we do not have enough skilled and highly skilled workers to get the benefit of all those developments. And we need to upskill our lower level employees to be able to be ready to fill positions and to be more productive in this new way of working and living as we move forward.
And just a final one then, let's find a silver lining here. Second consecutive year of real earnings growth, that is good. Do you think it's sustainable, or are there risks that could erode that momentum?
Jeremy, I think a lot of this hinges on inflation. So if we are going to move to a 3%, you know, target, and, you know, going to start to move into an environment where, you know, escalations in the economy, converge towards 3%, then one can start to think about this as a more longer term potential trend. However, you know, if you just look at the short-term forecast for inflation, we are moving towards 4% already for next year. So then you have to start to think about a wage increase of 5.5% just to keep this trend going. And that becomes perhaps taxing in an environment where growth is still quite sluggish.
And that's where we are going to leave it. I've been in conversation with economist Elise Kruger. We've been talking about Pay Inc's latest net salary index. Elise, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's transport network, roads, railways, ports, is creaking under years of neglect, efficiency and outdated infrastructure. So enter Dr. Oli Bogeng Bagaiki, transport economist at the Northwest University. He argues that our only real way out is a bold digital leap. The Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, sustainable mobility, and a clear national strategy for transport that encompasses all of that. The promise is faster freight, lower emissions, better connectivity, but obviously the obstacles are massive. And I want to test whether this idea could lead to any kind of action or simply just interesting rhetoric. Dr. Bagaiki, a very warm welcome. You suggest that digitalization could revolutionize the transport system in this country. Maybe let's look at the situation as it exists right now. Is there a single metric today that illustrates how far behind the curve we are?
Yeah, indeed, we are far behind, because in the whole world, I think we are sitting at number 40 countries that are trying to bring in to digitalize everything. We are far behind compared to many countries like the US and others like China, Singapore, Switzerland, and many others. We are very far behind. Well, our government is trying, because they have what they call the national digitalization strategy that is driven by a digital economy mission plan. And there is also a roadmap for digital transformation and government, but which is trying to improve the digital infrastructure and develop skills and enhance e-government service relating to that. But unfortunately, that is still done by government. I think at times we must move away from doing everything in totality by government, but privatize certain services for us to can move somewhere.
You highlight artificial intelligence-based route optimization. You talk about the Internet of Things for maintenance. Are there specific or real projects in South Africa right now that could use that kind of technology to scale?
There are so many projects that the government is trying to come up with, but we are moving at a very snail pace. When it comes to the information sharing, that's when now we can see that we are digitalizing. But when it comes to building of road infrastructure, using the airports and many others, we are not going there. I will make an example. I've been pleading to the provincial government here to say SAPS does not have infrastructure in the province, in the Northwest province. It does not have vehicles. It does not have other resources. But if they can introduce drones, you don't need to be there physically. You don't need people to be there physically, but you need just some people to run the drones so that you can check what is moving around in the province, so that we can minimize stock theft. But if that is not done, we are not going to go anywhere, because we cannot expect policemen to be everywhere, anytime.
Doctor, you're talking a big game here, but who pays ultimately for this digital transformation? Are you expecting state budgets, private investments, public-private partnership? What do you think is realistic in order to get some of your thinking off the ground?
I think the triple P model was the best model that has ever been developed in our country. But unfortunately, we are not implementing that fully. You know, in South Africa, we are good planners. We can plan, but the problem is the implementation part. Maybe we lack skill to can implement, but we need private sector to get involved. But the private sector at the same time, we are not talking about the tendering system. We're talking about the triple P arrangement, because we tried in the past where some airports were given to the private hands but could not work because we did not follow the triple P model. So if we can maybe come up with this triple P model, embrace it, ensure that it is working to the core, then we can see differences.
But the problem with the triple P approach is that the private sector wants less regulation. They want a real return on investment and less risk. And often within the transport paradigm, that doesn't exist, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Hence, I'm saying we need to embrace it. We have to work on the current plan. The plan is not that much bad, but we need to just rework on it, agree with the private sector on certain things like the issue of regulation, so that we can lessen the regulation. We can actually give them better offers so that when they are there, they know that there will be a return on investment that is lucrative to can attract them to come into the space. But at the moment, it's so difficult to do that, to work with them. That is why some of the projects are failing.
Just a final one and a quick answer, if you don't mind. You emphasize walking and cycling infrastructure as well. That's often something that we completely forget about.
Yes, of course. And that is where we are coming. Yeah, you know, beyond technology, we need sustainability. Sustainability is key. And that sustainability, it will rely on the fundamental social, economic, and political factors that will assist people. Because what is key is that you have to understand the culture of a particular community that you want to serve and align whatever project with the culture that is existing. We have to align yourself with the behavior of people, because to change someone's behavior is not an easy thing. And here we are talking about the social equity and inclusion of many people that are left outside. Now, we have people that have been walking, but they were surpassed by motorists. Now, whatever we are planning, we are thinking of a motorist. We are not thinking of non-motorized transport, but we need bridges for people to be able to walk from one area to the other. And again, that will also increase our lifespan, because now we'll be exercising in some form and we'll be reducing congestion, because congestion comes with many other ailments, such as the frustration that you are getting there as a driver and as a commuter sitting in a public transport. Is a frustration that will affect your health life. So we need to encourage those cycling and those walking, but we need infrastructure for that particular purpose.
Thank you very much indeed, Dr. Oli Bogeng Bagaiki, transport economist at the Northwest University.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's common cause that South Africa's digital skills gap remains one of the biggest barriers to youth employment and economic competitiveness. Now, Microsoft South Africa, in partnership with GIZ and the Department of Higher Education, launching something called Ikamva Digital. It's a free, mobile-friendly platform across 50 TVET colleges offering training in AI cybersecurity, cloud, software development, and multimedia, so the whole gamut. The goal, as I understand it, is to build the next generation of digital talent and prepare young South Africans for jobs in the fourth industrial revolution. All well and good. But here's the problem, I think. Can the platform scale impact fast enough, and is it really able to meaningfully shift employability outcome? That's an important issue. I'm in conversation now with Tiara Paython, who is AI Skills Director at Microsoft South Africa. Tiara, welcome to you. So this new process or initiative is positioned as a bridge to the digital future. How do you measure whether it becomes real employability and not just completing a course?
That's a really great question, right? When we built the platform, co-created with GIZ, we made a couple of assumptions in order to ensure success. What we didn't want to do is take away anything from that three-year qualification the TVET learner gains. You know, what we wanted to complement it with an industry-recognized certification, because what we understand and know is that many graduates still face unemployment. You know, they spend 3 years, you know, learning something really fantastic, and when they're ready to go out into the world of work, they don't have recognizable industry skills. And so that's a big challenge. So when we developed Ikamva, it was, you know, accessibility was at the heart of it. We wanted it to be mobile friendly. We wanted learners to be able to download content if they were offline, you know, which we know is really crucial in areas with limited connectivity. We've set ourselves up for a big job, but we have a team in the back end that is working to onboard all 50 TVETs. Its platform's built on Azure. It's on a Microsoft platform that allows for scale. The interface is intuitive, it's inclusive, and it caters to both students and educators. Mm. I think that this platform is going to be a game changer for South Africa, but it will only be as good as, you know, whether learners and students are actually using the content. So it's just like any kind of dashboard. It's only as good as the information gets put into it.
Tiara, I'm glad you mentioned connectivity, and it's laudable that you're partnering with TVET colleges, but many struggle with resources and obviously connectivity. Your big challenge is to ensure that rural students and low-income youth don't get left behind. How are you going to make sure that the net is spread equitably?
As I mentioned, Jeremy, I mean, TVET colleges, we know, they're at the heartbeat of South Africa's skills pipeline, right? They're not the first choice. Many students want to go to university. We are working, and this is why we're working with GIZ, right? They've done, I think, in 2022, research around all 50 TVETs, the infrastructure, connectivity. We know most students don't have access to connectivity or even devices. So when we built the platform, accessibility was the most important thing, because not everyone's on the same, you know, digital equity playing field. And I think it's going to work, because no learner's going to be left behind, not anyone registered today, but also alumni who's previously been at a TVET college. They will now also be able to access these five demand pathways. And what we've done in addition, Jeremy, is we've looked at where the kind of gap is in the market with vacancies that are open across South Africa, 95,000 cybersecurity vacancies. So learners will be able to go onto the platform. They'll be able to complete training in any of the five demand-led pathways: cybersecurity, data analytics, software development, cloud, as well as content development. So any kind of UI, UX. But we've not taken the assumption that everyone is at that level. We've also built in introductory pathways. And I think this answers your question around those that are in rural areas who may not yet be as digitally literate
as everyone else. We've built in full digital literacy from how to switch on a computer, how to get connected on the internet, as well as all of the Microsoft 365 content, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, Teams, OneDrive, you name it. So yes, we've made assumptions, but we've also made sure that it's inclusive as possible. We want to ensure that eCanva Digital is not just a platform, it's a launch pad for youth to thrive in, you know, emerging technologies.
How difficult is it going to be to guarantee job matching in a market where demand is constantly outstripping placement pathways?
I mean, you're right, Jeremy. Jobs will change all the time. We're not promising jobs, but what we are promising is to build an ecosystem of partners, like working with CollectiveX, with BePesa, the GBS sector, working with ALX, working with Yes for Youth. We can't do and solve the job placement challenge alone. We need to be able to work with industry leaders that, you know, work in this space for a very long time and that understand the challenges young people face. And, you know, I'm proud to say that when we had our launch on Tuesday, we had these industry partners in the room and we could, you know, raise these questions around how do we collectively move the needle of unemployment, because we can't do it alone. We need to start taking it seriously. Our young people, you know, they come with the creativity, the confidence and the commitment to complete the training. And, you know, as South African organizations out there, we need to come together better, and we need to be able to support these young adults.
Just a final question, and no one is doubting your altruism and your commitment to this whole initiative, but Microsoft content is powerful. There is a risk, surely, that the system becomes vendor-dependent instead of producing multi-stack digital talent.
I mean, that's a great question, Jeremy, but I think you would know there are lots of organizations across South Africa that, like AWS, like Google, like Huawei, Cisco, that are all doing very similar initiatives. And I know that although our platform is, yes, vendor specific, we have probably, you know, more people use Microsoft Outlook 365, you know, but people have preferences. Some prefer Google, some prefer Microsoft. What we're doing as an organization is really making it available, because we want to help accelerate employability. And this is why we've made this commitment and taking this bold step for South Africa, you know, to kind of build this pipeline of digital and AI-ready talent.
Thank you very much indeed, Tiara Payton, AI Skills Director at Microsoft South Africa. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.